Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi there again, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. I've done a few things over the last couple of months, which are a slight deviation from the way I've done this podcast for many, many years. And it doesn't mean to say that this is the new format, but I think it's important sometimes to kind of go in a slightly different direction. You know, normally the format for this podcast has been where I've, looked at somebody's writing, you know, whoever that might be, and really kind of helped explore it and look at the context of it and what they're arguing, what they're suggesting, and sometimes we hit some amazing books. And I always try to pick a good one, and occasionally you have to look at something that's not so great, but that's kind of the way I've always done things. Partly due to time constraints, partly due to just wanting to talk about things in a slightly different way, I'm looking at this slightly more conversational format, which I hope you'll like. And there are a number of things that I have often talked about, kind of railed against, and wondered. And particularly one of my particular areas of interest is the question of historical memory. How and why we collectively remember things in the way that we do, and what bearing that has on kind of objective reality. And the kind of rut, I think, that's what you might describe as kind of Anglo-America is stuck in, and generationally might be stuck in for the next couple of decades to come, is the kind of the memory of the Second World War in America, this kind of memory of the greatest generation in Britain, the memory of the few of the Spitfires that saw off the Luftwaffe over the South Downs, and the Londoners and people in Britain's big cities enduring the Blitz, the bombing of Britain's cities, and the heroic evacuation of the British Army, the British Expeditionary Force at Dunkirk. These things hold a powerful, deeply emotional grip over public imaginations. Wherever you go, there is something similar. People in virtually every country in the world have a narrative that defines their country. It is a narrative often, almost always based in some kind of exceptionalism. And it's powerful, and it's emotive, and it's generational and transgenerational. And it helps to answer the question of who we are. We are the people who had this happen to us. We are the people that triumphed over that. We're the people that did this good thing, survived that terrible thing. And that means we are a particular sort of people. Our national character is kind of like this. Or, and a lot of this is assisted myth making. A lot of this is the product of propaganda at the time. A lot of this is the product of war-winning measures at the time, and a lot of this is the product of post-war storytelling. If you take the example of Great Britain, the iconic photos of the taken by the Ministry of Information during the war, I think there's a classic photo of somebody delivering a milkman delivering milk after the Blitz. Well, you know, staged. And staged for a particular reason, because it was meant to resonate with a particular aspect of British society and culture, that whatever happens, we can endure this, we can ensure that life goes on as normal, we can show that we are not affected by the kind of the predations of Nazism, and that we are able to kind of to show our own kind of reserve, our own sense of Britishness, our own little bit of kind of eccentricity, our refusal to engage in kind of defeatism or drama. It's a way that British people, I make broad brushstrokes here, that it is a way that it is believed that British people like to think about themselves. Whenever you make broad statements that British people think this, American people think that, Dutch people think this, or Chinese people think that, well, you know, it's doubtful that you mean everybody. It's and probably when you get down to it, all assumptions are wrong and offensive. But often the way in which propagandists work is they try to tap into a thing they assume that particular populations like to think about themselves as. The great myth, though, and Jeffrey Wheatcroft wrote an incredible article, one of these long read articles in The Guardian, quite a long time ago now. I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago. The great myth, though, is the idea of the good war, that the Second World War was the good war. If you look at it from a very narrow Anglo-American perspective, you might be forgiven for thinking that. It is without question the Nazism is the great evil of the 20th century. Stalinism and Maoism is kind of like a photo finish. If you consider that in the late 1950s to early 1960s, Mao's famines killed figures vary, but potentially as many people as were killed in the entirety of the Second World War. You get a sense of kind of how monstrous Maoism turned out to be. Stats, you can read a variety of books on Mao's famines, and they range from 40 million to around 70 million dead. And some figures put that up to beyond 120 million. So it kind of depends who you ask. But an enormous toll of human misery. But the binary kind of division between a liberal democratic Western allied alliance of firstly Britain and France, and then after and then France falls in the summer of 1940, then after Pearl Harbor Britain and America on one side and Soviet Russia on the other, against this genocidal, racist, eliminationist, kind of monstrous militarism of Nazism and its kind of hanger-on powers in allies in Italy, Vichy France, fascist Hungary, and a variety of other kind of client states. There seems to be, at first glance, no argument that this was the good war. It was the war fought against this ultimate of all evils. And yet, we don't live in Star Wars. We don't live in a world where binary moral oppositions such as good and evil function in that way. The kind of the last great proponent of this was, in fact, George W. Bush. There's a really good book by Peter Singer called The President of Good and Evil, which points out that George W. Bush used the language of good and evil post 9/11 more than any other president has done, and I imagine probably has done, probably no American president has done since. Even Trump, I don't think so. And that kind of simple, it created sort of simple binary oppositions in the war on terror, which, you know, conveniently for the neocon agenda, negate the complexities of you know, decades of Middle East politics, and give American voters an easy answer to the question of, well, why do they hate us? And it's something to do with, you know, good and evil, which of course it's hard to dispute when somebody flies a plane into the World Trade Center that they have committed an act of evil. But obviously, the reasons for wars and conflicts are far, far more complex than that. The reason Jeffrey Wyckoff cites, which is so fundamental that against the idea of the Second World War being the good war, is that the Second World War is all overwhelmingly fought against civilians. The majority of the casualties of people who died in the Second World War, from the cities of London through to China, the Philippines, the famines that grip part of Asia, the Holocaust, obviously, the millions of Soviet citizens who died, the starvation of the citizens of Leningrad. This was a war fought against civilian populations. The soldiers who died, and airmen and sailors who died, are dwarfed by the numbers of civilians who died. You could say, well, a war that is fought to end the kind of the tyranny of Axis powers, you know, murdering civilians, well, that is morally justifiable. Okay, sure, yeah, but if you the Allied bombing of Germany, again, was a war fought largely against civilians. Whatever moral sense you want to make of that, it starts to question this kind of this notion of the Second World War being the good war. If the easiest comparison to make is against the First World War. The First World War being this kind of, in Europe, this fixed war of position involving trenches and no man's land and barbed wire and gas and all these kinds of things. The great catastrophe that is burned into the imagination of the British after the First World War, and that kind of informs politicians, diplomats and military planners, is the first day of the Somme, where about 54,000 casualties happened, of which about 19,000 were fatalities in one day of fighting. The rest of the Somme campaign obviously consumes far, far more soldiers. The numbers of British and Imperial war dead in the First World War come to a little over 1 million. Obviously, these are far bigger numbers than the loss of life in the Second World War. The loss of life in the Second World War for British soldiers is significantly, and Commonwealth soldiers is significantly lower. But that kind of gives us the, you know, if you're looking at it from a British perspective, or from the perspective of somebody who existed between the wars, then that sort of gives a kind of a skewed idea about the Second World War. And if we look at it from a kind of a global perspective, which indeed I think we should, where we're looking at the loss of life and the kind of the destructiveness, the Second World War's kind of development of military power, aircraft, tanks, artillery, and mass bombing, and then finally nuclear weapons. These were all kinds of innovations that flowed from the First World War. The military planners looked to air power to prevent the kind of the disasters on the battlefield happening again. They looked to modern tank technologies and strategies to prevent a war of position in Western Europe from happening again. And by the summer of 1940, Germany is able to demonstrate the use of kind of rapid armor and aircraft in blitzkrieg strategies to ensure that the Low Countries and France fall rapidly. This in turn kind of confounds part of Stalin's strategy. Stalin was hoping that a war of position would occur on the Western Front, that it would grind Europe down in war for long enough, several years he hoped, that he would have the opportunity to rearm and defend Russia. So the First World War and the Second World War exist in a kind of a dynamic relationship with one another. It's not a kind of a controversial sort of claim. Eric Hobsbawm comes out with this one, that what existed from 1914 to 1945 was a kind of like a 31 years war with a kind of a brief interlude in the middle. The most recent proponent of this in his amazing book Blood and Ruins is Richard Overy. Richard Overy's basic argument is that you have from 1914 to 18 a war of European empires, and then it's during the from 1918 to 1939 you have an attempt by the two remaining European empires to kind of reinforce their positions and to grab as much territory as possible and to kind of survive the kind of the post-war economic fallout as best they could do. And then you have these new kind of competitor states in the guises of Japan, Germany and Italy looking to seize territory for themselves and to become essentially new rival empires. It's easiest to see that in when you look at Japan and the Second World War. Japan's attempt to build its co-prosperity sphere in Asia at the expense of the British, Dutch and French empires, and kind of in the case of America, the America's protectorate in the Philippines. And this is something that is in the eyes of Japanese nationalists at the time, both kind of liberal and fascist, the idea that Japan should be the kind of the leader of Asia and should somehow contribute to this kind of mass liberation of Asia, that this would be Japan's role. So Overy argues that you have this war of unprecedented violence isn't a war of good and evil as we imagine it. It's not a good war. It is a war of empires. It is imperialism's war. And unfortunately, not imperialism's last war. The result is that the insurgent empires, Japan, Italy and Germany, are destroyed, extinguishing the last kind of gasps of the Anglo and French empires, which within 2 to 3 decades of the end of the Second World War have vanished, but creating a new kind of empire in the guise of the Soviet Union, which colonizes Eastern Europe and a variety of other kind of parts of its periphery, places such as like Azerbaijan, and then the United States of America, which with its unofficial empire, it's undeclared but evidently their empire, manages to dominate world trade and diplomacy for the next half century. And there are more so than previously at the moment, there are debates about the kind of the rise of the BRICS nations and the limitations to America's hard and soft power. Some of which I think is probably overstated. America's hard power is still far in excess of the next half dozen rivals put together. And the idea that America could probably fight a war on multiple fronts again if it needed to, I think is entirely plausible. That is kind of speculation. But the fact is that America was a kind of a country that is born of supposedly kind of anti-imperial sentiments, and there's all sorts of accounts during the Second World War of resentful American generals all the way down to private soldiers thinking, what on earth are we doing fighting a war to help Britain hold on to its empire? And America manages, through its need to control world markets and its need to control its access to world trade and its need to establish itself as the world economic hegemon, constructs its own version of imperialism in the second half of the 20th century. An imperialism that right-wing historian Niall Ferguson has often described as essentially kind of benign, and as America is this kind of world policeman that ensures that the functioning of a world order happens as it should do in terms of the rules of world trade and access to sea lanes and all that kind of thing, which is no doubt the case. But obviously,
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imperial rule has meant imperial wars such as Vietnam and Iraq, and support at the moment for the genocidal crimes of the Netanyahu regime. But let's not kind of get sidetracked from our central thesis here. The Second World War is a war that cannot be defined through the prism of the kind of the Anglo-American gaze. When you have programs, I mean, the most recent one is Masters of the Air, which I've seen a bit of it and it looks absolutely phenomenal. But this is a way of telling the story of Anglo-America's war. There are obviously war stories told from Soviet, Chinese, German, and other perspectives. The 1990s version of Stalingrad, which I think is Wolfgang Petersen, is a classic example of that, and the series is Das Boot, which I think they've revived recently. Sure, these tell us about those perspectives. The Sam Peckinpah movie Cross of Iron, again another kind of classic example. But we are, you know, global culture, which is kind of led by the sort of the Anglophone world for and has been for the last half century, sees a kind of a particular version of the wartime experience, and it's an Anglo-American one. This is very, very narrow. This is very, very limited, and the idea that's kind of what the war was is highly misleading. There's a classic part of Tony Judd's memoirs, when in conversations with Timothy Snyder, quote from the book Thinking the 20th Century. Tony Judd, obviously a British Jewish intellectual and historian, talks about the experience of growing up in post-war London as a British Jew, and talks about how there were boys who had either come over on the to escape to Britain on the Kinder transport, or who'd had relatives who had survived the Holocaust, or there were Eastern European boys who he knew through the Jewish community who'd come to live in Britain as refugees after the war. And they described their wartime experience. They heard other boys talking about their dad's wartime experiences of being in the desert with Monty, or in, you know, at Dunkirk, or in the jungles of Burma. And the kind of the alienating reality of saying, well, my dad's wartime experience is that he was kept in this really dark, terrifying place in the middle of Poland that you've probably never heard of. It just gives you that perspective that once again, this was a war that was fought primarily against civilians, but it's also a war where the narrative is the narratives that are available in order to understand and navigate this kind of long historical process are hugely diverse, and we have heard kind of but a sort of a sliver of that. The popular understanding of the Holocaust, for example, was very, very limited. The first recognition, that popular recognition in Great Britain, that something truly terrible had, or that truly terrible things had happened in the Nazi Germany far, far worse than anyone could possibly have imagined. There were all sorts of, you know, the knowledge of kind of the Gestapo and Hitler's sort of authoritarian measures and anti-Semitism were well understood in British newspapers before the war. Death camps were and sites of mass killing were not widely understood by the British population until the end of the Second World War. But the first evidence that the British population saw was the Pathé newsreel of Bergen-Belsen, or not Pathé, in fact, actually, it was BBC newsreel of Bergen-Belsen, narrated by the veteran journalist Richard Dimbleby. It for American audiences or non-UK audiences, particularly if you're listening in the United States, Richard Dimbleby during the Second World War was the kind of figure that, say, Walter Cronkite was during the Vietnam War. This is the trusted voice of the establishment, the person who you listen to. He narrated these scenes which I think haunted him to the end of his life from Bergen-Belsen. At no point in the newsreel was the word Jews used. And this was a deliberate omission. Prisoners, yes, but not Jews. And at the time, it was considered to be too incendiary. There were Churchill and Roosevelt, both Tony Judd and Timothy Snyder wrote this extensively. Churchill and Roosevelt were well aware of the anti-Semites that existed in Britain and America. And it was always a kind of a risky undertaking, and gave the Oswald Mosleys of the world a free pass if it was suggested that the Second World War had been fought to liberate the Jews or to help them in any way. This is something that kind of opportunist anti-Semites understood that they could use in order to kind of weaponize and say, oh, well, look, we were tricked into this conflict against our neighbours in Germany who had done no wrong, really, because we had, Jews had sort of, you know, conned us into this. If you can just imagine the sorts of thing, the sorts of kind of lies that fascists come out with. Roosevelt and Churchill were very, very kind of conscious of this. Important to kind of downplay, in a way, anti-Semitism and to kind of ignore as much as possible what the Nazis had done to the Jews. Not entirely, but the British public had a kind of didn't quite have the understanding of it that it does now. Another reason for not deliberating too much or not focusing too much on the question of the Holocaust at the end of the Second World War was that British people, the British public at the end of the Second World War had a sense that the war had been about something, that the war had a particular narrative. Again, it was a kind of a triumph of good over evil, of freedom over tyranny, and that the war's sacrifices had to mean something, and mean something particular to the British public. You will no doubt find a version of this everywhere you go. The version that the Second World War has in the Soviet Union, the Great Patriotic War, negates huge inconvenient facts about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact that lasted until 1941 and the various kind of failings of Stalin from 1941 onwards. That led to the devastation of Russia, and the terrible acts such as the Katyn massacre of Polish officers who were taken prisoner by the Soviets, and the Soviet Union's decision to stand by and let Warsaw be razed to the ground to destroy the Polish opposition. All of this is kind of sort of airbrushed from the narrative, and instead you have the country who comes back from the brink of defeat to destroy the ultimate evil of Nazism, and the fact that you have Soviet soldiers liberating Auschwitz, another of the death camps in Poland, is kind of testament to that fact, in a way. That's is the way in which the narrative, the historical memory of the Second World War, can easily be shaped. Again, in America, the historical memory of the Second World War kind of begins with, for the most part, the attack on Pearl Harbor and America's kind of entry into the war, and ends with this idea of kind of the greatest generation having returned liberty to the world. And you know, if only it were that simple. I mean, it's a little, I know it's a little shooting fish in a barrel to point out our sort of shared delusions about the war and the past, but I think it is really important to do so, because when we cling to these sorts of kind of naive ideas about this hugely complex and violent and destructive period in world history, we allow ourselves to sort of import some of these kind of notions into the present, and we allow that to kind of inform how we sort of navigate the present moment. If you want to kind of look for any kind of an example of that, one of the key kind of moments in the Brexit campaign was Nigel Farage and various other sort of fraudulent characters sailing a flotilla of small boats down the River Thames in London, and everybody of a kind of a certain age and a certain mentality in Britain knows what that symbolizes. The small boats that supposedly, they actually didn't, but that's a whole other story, that helped the British to escape from Dunkirk, the British Expeditionary Force. The flotilla of small boats was a kind of a PR myth. There were some, but they acted normally as a taxi service from the beaches to get men onto warships, which were it was the Royal Navy that brought the British Expeditionary Force home. But when you're trying to swing a referendum to take Britain out of the European Union, to retransform it as a kind of like a right-wing dominated state to kind of asset strip, who cares? These are simply just the means of tapping into powerful and emotional ways that people in Britain and kind of people everywhere else have of navigating the past in order to explain the present and somehow magically predict the future, a future that we can all try to imagine, where, you know, these wonderful values that we once had in the 1940s can help to navigate ourselves through the complexities of the 21st century. Well, good luck with that. So they instead of this kind of binary opposition between good and evil, we have an axis, the imperial predations of axis powers, which lead to wars, famines, and genocides, which are, you know, by any moral stretch, any stretch of the kind of the moral imagination, unutterably evil. And they are opposed by a British Empire that had been born of slavery, that had been born of imperial conquest, that had subjugated and created famines across India, and there is a United States whose racism flowed so deeply that its army was segregated, its black soldiers treated as second-class citizens, and its model of kind of expropriation of land that was carried out in the mid to late 19th century, the destruction of the Plains Indians and the colonization of the Great Plains, was Hitler's model for what should happen in Russia. So it's not to suggest for a moment, and I don't actually believe this, that Britain and America were as monstrous as Nazi Germany. No, I don't think so. But what I do think is that we're not really talking about good guys and bad guys. We're talking about the operations of empires, and empires going to war with one another for resources, and empires are inherently monstrous things. And the people, the human beings that get in the way of empires, are the ones who tend to be wiped out in the most brutal and monstrous of ways. And so the Second World War, or the 31 Years' War from 1914 to 1945, is a war of empires. It is a global conflict of empires that ends only with nuclear warfare, and nuclear warfare becoming such a risk to humanity that great powers are unable or unwilling to go to war with one another again. And what you find is that for the rest of the 20th century, great powers are able, with impunity, to go to war against minor powers or lesser powers, and that post-colonial wars happen between decolonized states. So my kind of great book recommendation, there are several I've talked about in this podcast, but if you're looking for something really comprehensive to read, get Blood and Ruins by Richard Overy. It's a fantastic read, and it sets out a really, really meticulous thesis. I couldn't recommend it enough. Anyway, I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. This has been a slightly longer one today, but there you go. Take good care, all the best, and I'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you, awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.